Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
After 281 days in captivity, Elizabeth Smart was finally home. But the nightmare wasn't over, because now she had to do something that might have been even harder than surviving: tell the world exactly what happened to her. And her captor had one last move, an insanity defense that would tie the court in knots for nearly a decade. Today, I'll take you inside Elizabeth's captivity, through the legal battle that followed, and into the remarkable life she built on the other side of it. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are, that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. Crime House exists because of listeners like you. Want even more? Join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com. Or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of America's Most Infamous Crime Show page. And to help keep growing our community, be sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of kidnapping, sexual assault, captivity, and substance abuse. So please listen with care. This is the final episode on the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart. Today, I'll walk you through what Elizabeth endured during those 9 months in captivity, the years-long legal battle to bring her captors to justice, and how she turned one of the most horrific experiences imaginable into a lifelong mission to protect other children. After Elizabeth Smart was rescued on March 12, 2003, the immediate relief gave way to a harder reality. The police needed to understand exactly what happened to her during the 281 days she'd been missing. The full picture would take time to emerge. Elizabeth was traumatized, exhausted, and still processing the fact that she was safe. But over the weeks and months that followed, she began to give her account, first to law enforcement in detailed interviews, and eventually, years later, on the witness stand. Here's what she told them. After Brian Mitchell led her up into the Wasatch Mountains on the night of June 5th, 2002, they arrived at a makeshift campsite where Wanda Barzee was waiting. The first thing they did was padlock a long steel cable around Elizabeth's ankle and hook it to a tree so she couldn't run. Then Wanda washed Elizabeth's feet, preparing her for what Brian called a wedding ceremony. Brian told Elizabeth she was going to be his second wife. He gave her a new name, Shir Jashub, and then he sexually assaulted her. It was the first night of a captivity that would last 9 months. From that point on, Elizabeth's old life, her family, her harp, her faith, the bedroom she shared with her little sister, Mary Catherine, it existed only as memories that Brian was determined to erase. Over the next few days, Elizabeth could hear search parties calling her name from the hills around the camp. Volunteers were combing the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains, and they were close. But every time they got near, Brian pulled out his knife and told Elizabeth that if anyone came within the sight of the camp, he would kill them. So she stayed silent, watching her chance at rescue drift away. And eventually, the voices disappeared. Each time it happened, Brian took it as a sign that God was protecting them, that their mission was righteous and divinely blessed. The next couple of months were a blur. Elizabeth didn't see anyone but Brian and Wanda during that time. Brian assaulted her daily, while Wanda waited outside the tent. He told Elizabeth that she was Wanda's handmaiden, which basically meant her slave. Wanda forced her to do backbreaking manual labor around the camp, hauling water, gathering wood, cooking, cleaning, whatever needed doing in their makeshift settlement in the mountains. The cable around her ankle kept her tethered like an animal. Meanwhile, Brian spent most of his time drinking and using drugs. He forced Elizabeth to drink alcohol and use substances alongside him, which for a devout 14-year-old Mormon girl was deeply violating on top of everything else she was enduring. Brian justified all of it by claiming he was a prophet, a soul purified by God. According to him, he could do anything he wanted because he always had God's blessing. The rules that applied to everyone else didn't apply to him. And as part of that so-called divine plan, Brian told Elizabeth he needed more wives. He said God wanted him to marry 7 virgins who would bear divine offspring. After Elizabeth, he still needed 6 more. He talked about it constantly with the same delusional certainty he brought to everything else. One day, while Brian was ranting about his mother's restraining order, he mentioned the neighborhood where she lived. Without thinking, Elizabeth mentioned that her 15-year-old cousin Olivia lived in the same area. Soon after, Brian announced that God had spoken, Olivia would be his next wife. On July 24th, 2002, Brian went to her house, but he ultimately decided to try and kidnap Elizabeth's other cousin, Jessica. As he tried to cut his way into the room, Jessica's dad heard the sounds, ran in, and scared Brian off. If you remember from our first episode, this was the same break-in police dismissed as a prank. It wasn't until Elizabeth was rescued months later that they understood that the culprit was Brian David Mitchell. And with Brian in the clear for the moment, he started acting even bolder with Elizabeth. He started bringing her into Salt Lake City, dressing her in long robes and heavy veils so no one could see her face. She was right there, in the middle of a city that was looking for her, and she couldn't say a single word. Brian had told her he would kill her family if she ever tried to escape or call for help, and she looked in his eyes enough times to know he meant it. But Brian knew that staying in Salt Lake long-term wasn't an option. So in October of 2002, he decided to take them all to California. The trip was a disaster from the start. They were unhoused and nearly starving, living in makeshift camps around San Diego. Brian and Wanda fought constantly. The three of them drifted from parks to shelters to street corners with no plan and no stability. It was during this time that Elizabeth was most visible, wearing robes but not always veils, her face uncovered in public, and still nobody recognized her. After Brian's arrest for breaking into a church in February of 2003, he decided it was time to move on again. Maybe to New York, Philadelphia, or Boston. Elizabeth knew she couldn't let that happen. The further they traveled from Salt Lake City, the less likely she was to ever be found. Every mile east was another mile between her and any chance of rescue. She'd never manipulated anyone before in her life, but Elizabeth realized that if she didn't do something to influence Brian's decision, she might never see her family again. So she came up with a plan. She knelt down and said a silent prayer. "Let this work, and I will never manipulate anyone again." Then she turned to Brian and Wanda, who were still arguing about where to go, and calmly announced that she had a feeling they should return to Salt Lake City. She wondered if maybe it was a sign from God, but only Brian could answer that, because he was the prophet. She flattered his ego, calling him God's best friend, and that as the great prophet, he could use his divine position to ask God for guidance. Brian bought it completely. After a few minutes of prayer, he announced that yes, God had spoken. They were headed back to Salt Lake City. At the end of February, after about 4.5 months in California, the three of them boarded a bus heading back to Utah. It was a brilliant, desperate gamble. A 14-year-old girl who had been terrorized and assaulted for 9 months figured out how to use her captor's own delusions against him. And it may have saved her life, because shortly after they stepped off that bus in a Salt Lake City suburb, Brian and Wanda were recognized and arrested.
Yeah. Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa Richardson. On a special 4-episode conspiracy theories, cults, and crime series, I'm taking you to 4 kinds of dream getaways that went from paradise to deadly. A woman vanishes while snorkeling off Aruba, 2 backpackers murdered on a moonlit beach in Thailand, an NBA champion who disappears off his own catamaran in the South Pacific. These were supposed to be the trips of a lifetime. Listen to our special Deadly Destinations series every Sunday on conspiracy theories, cults, and crimes. Or if you don't want to wait, all 4 episodes are available right now, ad-free, on Crime House Plus. To join Crime House Plus, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at crimehouseplus.com.
With Brian David Mitchell and Wanda Barzee in custody, prosecutors thought they had a rock-solid case. They had Elizabeth's detailed testimony, they had physical evidence from the campsite, and they would eventually have Wanda's cooperation. But they were immediately hit with a legal challenge that would delay justice for years. Brian and Wanda's defense attorneys claimed their client suffered from severe mental illness and weren't competent to stand trial. Multiple psychiatrists evaluated them and came back with all kinds of diagnoses, including delusional disorder and paranoid schizophrenia. The question wasn't whether they committed the crimes. Everyone knew they had. The question was whether their mental states were so compromised that they couldn't understand the legal proceedings against them or assist in their own defense. And in January of 2004, less than a year after Elizabeth was rescued, a court found that Wanda was incompetent and transferred her to a Utah State Hospital for treatment. A year and a half later, in July of 2005, a state judge issued the same ruling for Brian. And that's where the case got stuck. For years, it sat in legal limbo while doctors and courts tried to determine whether Brian and Wanda were genuinely delusional or putting on a performance. It created a legal nightmare. Brian's competency had to be established before a trial could even begin, and he was doing everything in his power to make that as difficult as possible. He disrupted competency hearings by singing hymns at the top of his lungs and delivering long, rambling religious rants in the courtroom. He refused to engage with his own attorneys or acknowledge the authority of the court. Every outburst made him seem like a man so disconnected from reality that he couldn't meaningfully participate in his own trial. The prosecution's entire strategy hinged on proving the opposite, that Brian David Mitchell was not a delusional prophet on a mission from God, but a calculated predator who used religion as a tool to justify kidnapping, rape, and enslavement. They argued that his behavior in court was theater, not mental illness. They pointed to the deliberate, methodical way he'd planned the kidnapping, casing the smart home, identifying the unalarmed door, choosing his victim, bringing a knife. Those weren't the actions of a man lost in delusion. Those were the actions of a man who knew exactly what he was doing. Meanwhile, Wanda was refusing the medication that might restore her competency. But in June of 2006, a Utah judge ordered Wanda forcibly medicated, although her attorneys appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. After that appeal was denied in May of 2008, doctors were finally able to start medicating her, and it worked. By the end of 2009, Wanda had been deemed competent and pleaded guilty in federal court to kidnapping and enticement of a minor. She agreed to testify against Brian in exchange for a lighter sentence, and her statements confirmed everything Elizabeth had said. The cable, the ceremony, the daily assaults, the threats, all of it. With Wanda's cooperation in hand, prosecutors turned all of their attention to Brian. In March of 2010, 7 years after Elizabeth's rescue, Brian was finally deemed competent to stand trial. But rather than follow Wanda's example and plead guilty, Brian decided to take his chances in court and he entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. Elizabeth had waited years for this moment. She'd rebuilt her life piece by piece while the wheels of justice slowly turned. And now she was ready to face the man who'd taken so much from her. Brian's trial started in November of 2010. From the very beginning, nobody in the courtroom denied that Brian David Mitchell had kidnapped Elizabeth Smart. The only question was whether Brian was legally sane at the time he did it. He was facing a life sentence either way, but a verdict in his favor could mean spending that time in a psychiatric hospital instead of a federal prison. The defense team painted Brian as a paranoid schizophrenic on an imaginary mission from God, a man so lost in his delusions that he genuinely believed he was doing something holy. The prosecution argued that he was a master manipulator who wrapped his crimes in religious language to control the people around him and justify acts he knew were wrong. Throughout it all, Brian continued to make the trial a circus. The judge had to remove him from the courtroom multiple times for singing and disrupting proceedings. But the case kept moving forward, and eventually, Elizabeth took the stand. By then, it had been almost 8 years since her kidnapping, and Elizabeth had refused to let the trauma she'd endured keep her from living a full life. She finished high school and went on to college, majoring in harp performance. Music had been her anchor through the darkest period of her recovery. And in 2009, she traveled to France as a Mormon missionary, where she met her future husband, Matthew Gilmore. Elizabeth was no longer the terrified 14-year-old in a robe and veil. She was ready to face the man who had taken so much from her. On the witness stand, Elizabeth didn't shy away from any of the details of her captivity. She described what Brian had done to her with a clarity and directness that left the courtroom silent. She talked about the daily assaults, the cable around her ankle, the threats against her family, the forced substance use, the isolation, all of it. Her testimony was devastating, and it cut through the defense's central argument. Because Brian Mitchell may have been eccentric, he may have believed strange things, and he may have lived outside the boundaries of normal society. But through Elizabeth's account, the jury could see that he also understood consequences. He understood cause and effect. He understood that what he was doing was a crime, which is why he went to such extraordinary lengths to hide it. And on December 10th, 2010, after deliberating for less than a day, the jury rejected the insanity defense. Brian David Mitchell was found guilty on all counts: kidnapping and unlawful transportation of a minor across state lines with intent to engage in sexual activity. In May 2011, he was sentenced to two consecutive life terms in federal prison without the possibility of parole. As for Wanda Barzi, she was already serving her 15-year sentence as part of a plea deal. She was released from prison in September of 2018, a decision that Elizabeth publicly opposed. And in a terrifying development, she moved into an apartment just a few blocks from an elementary school. Although as a registered sex offender, she wasn't allowed to go on the school grounds or any public parks. Thankfully, it seems like she listened to the first requirement, but in 2025, she was arrested after going to a public park, claiming that God had told her to feed the ducks. As of this recording, it's not expected that she'll serve additional jail time. But this isn't her story, it's Elizabeth's. And after nearly a decade of competency hearings, delays, forced medication, and legal maneuvering, the case was finally closed. But although she was moving forward, people still had questions about what happened. One of the biggest questions people asked after Elizabeth's rescue was, why didn't she run? As early as August 2002, just 2 months into her captivity, she was eating at restaurants and walking through crowds in downtown Salt Lake City. She was in homeless shelters, at laundromats, and public libraries. There were dozens of moments where she could have called out to a stranger, started running, grabbed someone's arm, and said, "Help me." So why didn't she? Some people speculated that it had to do with her Mormon faith, that maybe she was so ashamed of the sexual abuse that she didn't think she was worth saving. Others pointed to Stockholm Syndrome, a rare and poorly understood condition where hostages sometimes develop positive feelings toward their captors. Brian had definitely worked hard to break down Elizabeth's identity and sense of self. He changed her name, her clothing, her entire world. He told her she should be grateful for being kidnapped and wrapped all of it in a language designed to make the abuse seem like a gift from God. But Elizabeth herself has been clear about why she stayed. In her memoir, she wrote that she had absolutely zero left for Brian David Mitchell. The reason she didn't run or speak up was simple. She was 14 years old, and she was terrified. Brian had repeatedly threatened her life. He'd threatened to kill her family and anyone who tried to take her away from him. Even after she was rescued, that fear was hard to shake. It took Elizabeth time to truly trust that she could tell the truth and not be punished for it. If you ask me, that's not Stockholm Syndrome. That's a child who has been terrorized into silence. And the fact that some people still question why she didn't run says more about how poorly we understand trauma than it does about Elizabeth. But Elizabeth Smart didn't just survive. She transformed it into something that would outlast the pain. Rather than retreating from public life after the trial, Elizabeth chose to become a full-time advocate for missing children and survivors of abuse. She established the Elizabeth Smart Foundation and started delivering dozens of speeches a year to audiences across the country. She spoke at schools, at conferences, at law enforcement training events, at churches, at congressional hearings, telling her story over and over again, just so she might reach someone who needed to hear it. And her advocacy work wasn't just limited to speaking engagements. Elizabeth testified before Congress in support of federal legislation to create a national sex offender registry. Her efforts helped pass the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006, named for the son of America's Most Wanted host, John Walsh, who'd helped Ed Smart get Brian Mitchell's face on national television. Along with providing grant money for programs dedicated to preventing crimes against children, the law gave social workers access to a national crime database, allowing them to share reports of child abuse across agencies for the first time. That kind of database could have helped police zero in on Brian much sooner, based on his ex-wife Debbie's allegations that he'd abuse her daughters. If those reports had been connected across jurisdictions, Brian David Mitchell might have been flagged as a predator long before he ever walked up to the Smart family's house. Elizabeth also used her platform to challenge deeply held beliefs within her own Mormon community. The LDS Church teaches abstinence before marriage. And the state of Utah, where the church has a significant cultural influence, has historically favored abstinence-based sex education in public schools. The problem is that those beliefs can create enormous stigma for victims of sexual assault, as if being violated makes you less pure, less worthy, less whole. For a survivor like Elizabeth, who had been sexually assaulted daily for 9 months, that framework was not just unhelpful, it was actively harmful. In a 2013 speech at Johns Hopkins University, Elizabeth told the story of a teacher she'd once had who compared sexually active women to a piece of chewed up gum. The implication was clear. Once you'd been used, nobody would want you. Elizabeth rejected that idea completely. She wasn't a piece of gum. She was a remarkable, vibrant human being with dignity, and she deserved to be seen as one. Her comments sparked a national conversation about how we talk to young people about sexuality, consent, and the difference between what happens to you and who you are. Elizabeth published her memoir, My Story, in 2013, followed by Where There's Hope in 2018. Both books detailed her captivity and recovery with the same unflinching honesty she'd brought to the witness stand. She shared not just what had been done to her, but how she'd fought her way back from it, one day at a time, with the support of her family and her faith. The books became bestsellers and reached millions of readers. Many of them had survived their own traumas and saw Elizabeth's story as a way to move forward without pretending the past didn't happen. Elizabeth Smart was taken from her bed when she was 14 years old. She was held captive for 9 months by a man who called himself a prophet and a woman who followed him without question. She was abused, degraded, threatened, and silenced. She was walked through the streets of her own city, past people who loved her and couldn't say a word. She endured things that nobody should ever have to experience. And when she finally got the chance to speak, she didn't just tell her own story. She used her voice to make sure that what happened to her would be harder to do to someone else. She fought for new laws. She challenged the beliefs that shame survivors into silence. She stood on stages across the country and told other people who had been through the worst that they were still whole, still worthy, and still capable of building a life on the other side of it. In life, we don't always get a say in the terrible things that happen to us, but we get a choice about what we do next. Elizabeth Smart chose to turn her tragedy into purpose, and she's been doing it every single day since. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts, so make sure to comment below.
The insanity defense took years to resolve. Do you think Brian David Mitchell was actually mentally ill, or was it all an act?
I think there's probably some genuine mental illness there. You don't live the way Brian Mitchell lived, abandoning your children, roaming the country in robes, and genuinely believing you're a prophet without something being off. But the legal question isn't whether he's mentally ill, it's whether his mental illness prevented him from understanding that what he was doing was wrong. And I think the evidence is pretty clear that it didn't. He knew to threaten Elizabeth into silence. He used fake names with the police. He disguised Elizabeth so she wouldn't be recognized. He fled to California when the heat was on. Those are not the actions of a man who's disconnected from reality. Those are the actions of someone who knows exactly what he's doing and is trying to get away with it. In my opinion, the jury definitely got it right.
Elizabeth's move to manipulate Brian into going back to Salt Lake City, that's remarkable for anyone, let alone a 14-year-old girl who'd been held captive for months. What do you make of that moment?
I think it's one of the most extraordinary details in this entire case. She recognized that Brian's ego was his weak spot. He needed to believe that God was speaking through him, that every decision he made was divinely ordained. And Elizabeth figured out how to use that against him. She framed the idea of going back to Salt Lake City as something that came from God, not from her. She called Brian God's best friend. She made him feel like he was the one making the decision. That's an incredible level of awareness and courage from someone who'd been terrorized for 9 months. And it probably saved her life, because if they'd gone to New York or Boston, I don't think anyone would have recognized Brian on the street. The America's Most Wanted coverage was strongest in Utah. She needed to get back there, and she found a way.
Elizabeth challenged the LDS Church's teachings on purity and sexual shame. That took courage in a different way. How significant do you think that was?
I think it was huge, and it wasn't just about the Mormon community, even though that's the specific context she was speaking from. The chewing gum analogy, the idea that once you've been used, you're worth less, that exists in a lot of religious traditions and a lot of secular spaces as well. Elizabeth standing up and saying, "I'm not a piece of gum, I'm a human being, and what happened to me doesn't define my value," is a message that not only the public, but definitely survivors everywhere needed to hear. And it took real guts to say it publicly, as a devout Mormon in a community where those teachings run deep. She wasn't trying to tear down her faith, she was trying to make it better, and I think she did.
Wanda Barzi was released in 2018 after 15 years and has been arrested multiple times since. Do you think her sentence was fair?
Personally, I think she should be behind bars. Yes, she started off as a victim and her cooperation was genuinely helpful to the prosecution in Brian's case. Her testimony confirmed Elizabeth's account and made the case against Brian stronger. Without her, the trial would have been harder. But on the other hand, Wanda wasn't an innocent bystander. She participated in the kidnapping, was at the campsite when Elizabeth arrived, forced a 14-year-old girl to do manual labor, and stood by while Brian assaulted Elizabeth day after day. 15 years feels light for all of that, and the fact that she's been rearrested since her release doesn't exactly inspire confidence that she's rehabilitated. And Elizabeth herself has said that she doesn't believe Wanda has changed, which I tend to agree with.
What's the one thing that stays with you most about this case?
I think it's definitely Elizabeth's resilience. She was a 14-year-old girl who had every reason to fall apart and never recover. 9 months of the worst abuse you can imagine. And instead of letting it destroy her or define her, she turned it into something meaningful. She built a foundation, helped pass federal legislation, challenged her own community's belief about purity and shame. She wrote books, she gave speeches, she raised a family. She chose every single day to be defined by what she did after, not by what was done to her. That's not something everyone can do. And the fact that she's been doing it for more than 20 years now is extraordinary. I think Elizabeth Smart is one of the most remarkable people I've ever had the privilege of covering on the show. Thanks so much for joining me for this series on the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart. Come back next week for another deep dive into a true crime that changed America. And to enhance your listening experience, join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime Show page. Hi everyone, it's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.